I wasn't anticipating speaking this morning. I was anticipating talking tomorrow evening as my first kind of official greeting as the scholar in residence at Unity of Bellevue. You know, and that will be at 7 tomorrow evening. You know, I know that it's strange for a church to have, even if a church is a spiritual education center, to have a rabbi as its scholar in residence, but I do want you to consider the response of my colleagues. I mean, if you think it's hard for you to explain it. So I had a title for tomorrow night's talk, but I didn't have a title for this morning's talk, and it reminded me of a story that Jamal, you know, we've been doing a lot of touring with Jamal and Don. Theoretically, it's book readings, but we found it boring to read out of the book. It's more fun to let other people read the book. So we've been using it as excuses to teach. And it's been very exciting. And one of the stories, Jamal talks about virtually a mythical character in Islamic tradition called the mullah. And one of my favorite stories has to do with a mullah who comes before a congregation to deliver a sermon. And the mullah says to the congregation, "Do you know what I'm going to talk about?" And the congregation says, "No." And he says, "Well, then what's the sense of me talking?" And he walks out. So the next time they invite him, they have prepared themselves. And when he asks, "Do you know what I'm going to talk about?" Everybody says, "Yes, we do." And he says, "Well, then what's the sense of talking?" And he leaves. So the congregation really wants to hear him, and they finally figured it out. They invite him again. He asks the same question, "Do you know what I'm going to talk about?" One half of the congregation says, "Yes, we do." The other side says, "No, we don't." He says, "Okay, you tell them." So I thought I would begin with by sharing something that I've been reading. I've been reading the Des Moines Register. You know, like, what do you do to light reading, putting yourself to sleep at night? Des Moines Register is great. I've been reading the 1967 edition of... I really haven't. There's in a memoir by Bill Boyson. He grew up in Des Moines. So he begins every chapter with a quote from the Des Moines Register, kind of setting the stage for that chapter. And I came across, you know, to be truthful, I say I came across. It's actually true that my wife, Ruth Newald Falcon, came across the quote and said, "You ought to read this quote." And I've been carrying it around with me for a couple of weeks because it kind of sums it all up. This is from the Des Moines Register of September 20th, 1967, should any of you feel inclined to check it out. And it's a marvel of journalistic style. East Hampton, Connecticut, and this is Associated Press. "A Search of Lake Pocotopog." It took me a week and a half to get the pronunciation of that. So I'm going to repeat it again just because pretty soon I'm not going to be able to tell this. "A Search of Lake Pocotopog for a reported drowning victim was called off here Tuesday when it was realized that one of the volunteers helping the search, Robert Hausman, 23, of East Hampton, was the person being sought." Now, that kind of says it all. I love that. Essentially, it's an affirmation that we're all seeking ourselves. And we are. Seeking ourselves and wondering who we really are. One of the things that we have been doing as Don and Jamal and I have been teaching, and one of the things we do in the book, which incidentally is for sale at the bookstore. Did you know that everyone here is required to buy a copy? Ah, well. Yeah, yeah. As I have tried that all over the country. It has yet to work, but you never know. One of the things we do is identify the core teaching of each of our traditions. It's like answering the question, what is Judaism for? What is Christianity for? What is Islam for? If all we're for is strengthening ourselves, perpetuating ourselves, that's really not a very great purpose. It's more like there's a puzzle that we're putting together, and each of us has been entrusted with a sacred piece of that puzzle, and our function is to bring that to the other. It's not that we all don't have aspects of all the teachings, but there is a focus. I think it's like that with each and every individual, too. I think the fact is that no matter where we are, we have something to bring to that situation. We have something to offer to make it better. To make it better in our homes, to make it better in our workplaces, to make it better in our communities, to make it better in our world. And I think in many ways that's the essential question. How can I make things better? Right here, right now. In the Jewish tradition, the core teaching is the evolving awareness of one. Normally one would say the core teaching is one God, but that doesn't really catch it. Because the notion of one, the awareness of one, the ability to conceive and perceive that one has evolved over time. And it continues to evolve. And the question is our understanding of the one evolving, or is the one evolving? And the answer, of course, is yes. You know, there was a time, with some mythical time of an Abraham, when we have the notion that ethical monotheism began. You know, the idea that there's one God, and because there is one, there are certain ethical imperatives having to do with how we treat ourselves, how we treat each other, how we treat our world. But in the time of Abraham, that one actually had company. And as the notion of that one developed, the company was seen as ineffective, and that one was seen as the only efficacious deity. But it was still the deity of the Hebrew people. Until sometime around the time of the early prophets, the prophetic tradition in the 8th century BCE, the time of Micah and the time of Amos, those prophets who noted that the community had fallen into an empty repetition of ritual and tried to call them back to the essence, to the substance of the faith, the substance of the tradition, and essentially said, that one God is the father, mother, that one God is the parent of all peoples, not just you. Have we not all one Father? Has not one Father created us all? Read father, mother, read parent. And it was Amos who said, just as God took the Hebrew people out of the enslavement of Egypt, so too God took the Canaanites out of their enslavement. God took all people out of whatever enslavements they encountered. which is to say that as the awareness of God evolved, God got bigger. Our awareness got bigger. And as that evolution has continued, what you and I share is an awareness that God is not some projection of an ego out there. God is this whole thing. There's a favorite verse, my current favorite verse in the Torah is from the book of Deuteronomy. It's in chapter 4, verse 35, in case any of you would like to check. It says, Hareta lada'at, it has already been shown you, ki Adonai hu ha'Elohim, that the absolute eternal one, the word for God that's used is the God that, the word that can't be pronounced because it's too big to be pronounced. You know how that goes. Every time we name something, we draw a circle around it, and everything that fits that name is inside the circle. Everything that doesn't is outside. Somewhere in the days of the Second Temple, probably around the 4th century BCE, a consciousness arose that one, there is no outside to that one. So naming becomes difficult. So to indicate that, the sacred name was no longer to be pronounced. It comes across, you know, some scholars think it was Yahweh or Yahweh. It wasn't. But even if it was, we wouldn't want to say it because the whole idea is to express something that's beyond name. So the verse says, that absolute, transcendent, inclusive aspect of God is the same one that awakens within each and every one of us. That unlimited presence awakens within us. The infinite awakening in the midst of the finite, which is the essential spiritual mystery with a capital M. And then the verse goes on and says, Ein od milvado, which is usually translated, there's none other beside that one. But as tradition has evolved, particularly in the mysticism of the 18th century, the line became translated more literally, Ein od milvado means there's nothing else besides that one. There's nothing else besides that one. My friend, who is Rabbi David Cooper, who wrote a book called God as a Verb, refers to the universe as godding. You know, to note that there's only one thing going on, which is all well and good, and we are still evolving our ability to apprehend that, our ability to celebrate that reality. But if we know that all is one, if we know that we are intricately connected, interconnected with each other and with all being, why does our world look like it looks? Why do our lives look like our lives look? How come we get into so much personal difficulty, family difficulty, community difficulty, world? Why are we out fighting wars if we know that all this is one, all this is part of one? How come we are living the kind of lives we are living? How come if we the behind? Through months. The four for settling into our old routines. And pretty soon there's less and less time that's focused on that relationship. And it can be with anything new and anything precious in our lives. And then we forget and we start taking things for granted. And that capacity to forget, that capacity to take things for granted, is itself not totally negative. There's all kinds of learning that we do that requires us to go on automatic, like learning to touch type or learning to drive a stick shift car. You know, where at the beginning it takes a great deal of concentration, it takes a great deal of thought, and then we go on automatic and we're able to do it. Some people think they can even drive while they're talking on a cell phone. No, forgetting, going on automatic, does work with some things in our lives, and it radically does not work with other things in our lives. In Jewish and Christian tradition, we are entering a time period now, and then as soon as there's some kind of security in that relationship, as soon as that relationship is set, we start settling into our old routines. And pretty soon there's less and less time that's focused on that relationship. And it can be with anything new and anything precious in our lives. And then we forget and we start taking things for granted. And that capacity to forget, that capacity to take things for granted, is itself not totally negative. There's all kinds of learning that we do that requires us to go on automatic, like learning to touch type or learning to drive a stick shift car. You know, where at the beginning it takes a great deal of concentration, it takes a great deal of thought, and then we go on automatic and we're able to do it. Some people think they can even drive while they're talking on a cell phone. No, forgetting, going on automatic, does work with some things in our lives, and it radically does not work with other things in our lives. In Jewish and Christian tradition, we are entering a time period now where we are focusing on our enslavement. You know, Passover and Easter this year are coinciding again, which they usually do. And both are reflect common themes, a theme of great darkness, where it doesn't look like there is any possibility of light, and then all of a sudden a light breaks forth. The images are different, the symbology are different, but the essential teaching is very similar. It's interesting to watch. And one of the things about approaching the Jewish holiday of Passover is the instruction in the Haggadah, which is the text that's read during a Seder meal, that says, in each and every generation, it is incumbent on each individual to experience it as if they themselves had been freed from Egypt. Which is interesting. It's not just a repetition of something that happened in history. It has something to do with what's going on in our own lives right here and right now. And the Hebrew word for Egypt, which is Mitzrayim, the Jewish mystics note, can be read Mitzarim, which means from out of the tight places, from out of the stuck places. So it's no longer a matter of a geographical drama. It's a matter of a drama of consciousness where we have limited ourselves once again through our forgetting of our essential nature. So the real question for all of us is, how the heck do we remember? How the heck do we even remember that forgetting has happened? That's easy, actually. When things start getting confused in our lives, when we start dipping into wells of unhappiness, where we get convinced of our limitations, where we stick to our stories, no matter how painful our stories are, we know we've forgotten. When we look in the mirror and we see everything that's wrong with us and nothing that's right with us, we have forgotten. When we look at those around us and see everything that's wrong with them and nothing that's right with them, we have forgotten. And those are cues. And the real question is then, how do we remember? I think some of the old myths are a way we developed to communicate with ourselves over time to help us remember. And one of those myths has to do with the revelation to Moses in the wilderness. We're enslaved in Egypt, right? Do you remember that? You probably don't remember that the book of Genesis, the first book of the Hebrew Bible, the first book of Torah, ends with everything being great. There was a great famine in the land. We were having trouble eating, but Joseph, the second youngest son of Jacob, had become the administrator of the land of Egypt. And he was the one that set aside food during the years of plenty so that during years of famine, the entire country and more could be fed. And sure enough, Joseph's brothers and family came down to get food. And once Joseph revealed himself to them and there was a reconciliation, the Pharaoh and Joseph brought the whole family down into Egypt, into the land of Goshen, which is particularly fertile territory. In other words, when we came to Egypt, we came to a promised land. And then the book of Exodus, the next book, begins and everything is terrible. It says, a new king has arisen who knew not Joseph, and we are enslaved. We are a slave people. Well, you know something about enslavement. That is the same thing I know about enslavement, and that is it doesn't just come from the external world. Enslavement is something we do to ourselves. We are in charge of that part. So it wasn't so much that an external authority had enslaved us, even though we love to blame the external and the outer world for whatever we experience. It's not that some king had forgotten Joseph. We forgot. And essentially, we forgot ourselves. We forgot who we are. And that's always the cause of our entry into enslavement. So we get Moses, who is being tutored in the spiritual way by a priest of Midian named Jethro. Interfaith interaction even then. Jethro tells him to go out with the flock into silence of the wilderness. And in that silence of the wilderness, something broke forth for Moses. It gets translated as a burning bush, and it's a terribly weak image. In those years, in that part of the desert, bushes were always burning. It was no big deal. No, it was spontaneous combustion. I mean, it really wasn't a big thing. Many years ago in a meditation, I had a vision of the fabric of reality being rent asunder by light. You know, the light that just once it opens up the fabric, it could consume everything. And that fit for me, the sentence, you know, Moses sees that light and it's not consuming. Realizing that that light has infinite power. That light is representing an energy which could just wipe everything away, but it's not. And from that energy, Moses perceives his mission, his purpose, his meaning in life. That he is to go down and he's to take the slave people from enslavement to freedom, which essentially is not so much a physical act as it is a psychological act. How do you take a people from the psychology of enslavement to a psychology of freedom. And Moses asks the most appropriate question. He says, when I go down there, they're going to ask me, who sent you? Who shall I say sent you? In other words, what's your name? And you know the name that's given. The name that Moses hears is Ehiyeh Asher Ehiyeh. It means I am as I am. The voice he hears says, go down and tell them I am has sent you. That's a peculiar thing to try to say to somebody. And, in fact, nobody ever asked Moses who sent him. It's not, again, about name. When we awaken to the greater I am, the I am without limit of space or time, the I am which is the ground of our individual identities, our smaller I ams. When we awaken to the energy of that I am, we awaken to renewed meaning and purpose in our lives. That's how it's done. Because that's awakening out of the confines of the particular story we are now telling ourselves about who we are, how we are, what our limitations are, what our problems are, what our possibilities are. To act out of that greater I am is to act with an authenticity that is palpable. When somebody acts out of that, it's just clear. It's like when Rob Cook plays piano. Nobody says, who told you you could play? One knows that that is the authentic expression of the heart of his being. He channels something through the uniqueness of his particular hands and his particular mind. When somebody is acting out of that, when we are acting out of that, clarity pierces the clouds of uncertainty and the clouds of unknowing. We step into the next phase of the evolution of our lives in the world. So the real question is, how do we do that? I mean, chances are very few of us have opportunities to be given charge of a flock of sheep and told to wander in the wilderness for days waiting for that light to pierce reality and awaken us. We got to do it right here. And that's why I wanted to do the meditation after the talk. Because I'd like to invite you into a space of remembering. So I'd like to encourage you to become aware of your breath. To settle in as best as you are able in this space and in this time. As we settle in, as we enter a space of greater silence, just on the edge of that silence, we can often witness the story start to ask for our attention. But when we really enter into a space, into the wilderness of our inner experience, we can watch and feel the grab of that story, and we can say, I hear you, but I am ready for something else now. I'm ready to let go. I'm ready to honor everything that's been. I'm ready to bless everything that's been. And I'm ready to open to that which is about to be. I'm ready to awaken to the eye behind my eye. the identity behind my identity. I'm ready to remember. I'm ready to remember not only what I've forgotten, but I'm ready to remember what I have not yet met. I am here, and I am ready. Perhaps to use those words as a simple mantra to repeat gently as a focus. Whenever the mind wanders, to simply repeat, I am ready. I am here, and I am ready. I am ready to awaken to the light that pierces my forgetting. I am ready to awaken to the light which illuminates that which I have not seen before. I am here, and I am ready. I am ready for the call to step into greater meaning and purpose in my life. I am here, and I am ready. I am ready to remember what I have forgotten. And I am ready to know what I have not known before. With every breath, I gather old tensions. And as I exhale, I release what needs to be released. With every breath, I am inspired by my universe. I am illuminated by the breath. I am here. And I am ready. I am here, and I am ready. Aware of the breath, aware of the body, and aware that in a moment, your eyes will open. And as your physical eyes open, let your inner eye open, that you might be here and that you might be ready, and that together we might discover, share, and celebrate dimensions of freedom, dimensions of meaning, and dimensions of purpose to which we are called. Take a gentle breath and let your eyes open.